Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 112, where we are discussing a 1969 book from Lawrence J. Peter and Raymond Hill, titled The Peter Principle, published by Buccaneer Books. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi there, this is Miranda calling from London in the UK.
Hi, this is Rohan, also from London in the UK.
And this is Pedro from Copenhagen.
And this is Tom from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Welcome, everyone. And this month we have a special episode. Every once in a while, we take a step away from the higher scholarly works and look at some popular books, things that are perhaps written by and for practitioners. This particular one is one that we've wanted to do for quite some time because it's one of those books that covers a topic that everybody kind of has heard about, but probably has not actually read the book. This is called The Peter Principle, and it's by Lawrence J. Peter, and that's how the principle gets its name. And probably all of us have heard of the Peter Principle, that everybody is promoted until they reach a level where they find themselves completely incompetent. What's interesting is the book takes that particular view and expands it out to about 100 and some odd pages of explanation of all of the implications of that. And what makes this book really interesting is that it is satire. And it's easy to forget that it's satire when you're reading it, because sometimes it's hard not to get upset at some of the assertions made or some of the examples used. So what I'd like to do is go ahead, offer a little bit of background on Dr. Peter, and then we'll just get right into the book, okay? The Dr. Peter, this is really was his main contribution to scholarship, which is interesting because it's satire. In his canon, he's got like about 8 or 9 books that are sort of like follow-ons to this. And other than that, his main contributions were in writing educational or textbooks for educators. A few, not a lot, but basically apart from that, this has been his lion's work. And rather than sort of building up to his big principle, he sort of puts it right up front. In a hierarchy, every employee tends to rise to his level of incompetence, and then he uses that to establish a whole new science called a hierarchyology. That's my attempt to pronounce it. And then basically lays out this whole new science and comes up with a glossary of about 200 terms, all derived from this one principle. So with that, let me just open the floor for your initial reactions, and then we'll see where we go with this.
I don't know about the rest of y'all, but in my case, Tom, I actually hadn't heard of the Peter Principle yet. So it was brand new, and it was quite a ride, I suppose, because I didn't necessarily expect the kind of tone and the combination of this kind of parody, but with a lot of profundity in it. The edition that I ended up reading, so I liked it so much that I ended up buying a book, which is like a newer print since 2009. And that had two things that I think are worth pointing out at the outset. One is it had a foreword by Peter, so before the introduction by Hull. And Peter talks about the kind of the background to this and how these are ideas. So this central idea of people rise to the level of incompetence. I mean, in essence, there's the one research question driving this whole book is why is there incompetence, so much incompetence around you? And they give all these examples of kind of just going to the post office and trying to get something done and kind of the small trivialities of life, but how frustrating those can be. Peter talks about how he presented that first in some kind of a conference in the kind of education sector where he was. He got mixed responses, including one person saying that they were just laughing, looking at their boss, turning red in the face. And then apparently the manuscript, which then he worked on with Raymond Hull, was rejected 14 times by publishers because they shopped it around for 2 years. And some would say you're treating some such important matter very lightly. Others would say this is too trivial and not important enough. And eventually, after kind of 2 years of trying, they managed to get it published. But the impact, as it turns out, has been a long one because, like I said, now there's this 2009 edition. Also an earlier now foreword by Bob Sutton at Stanford University. And Bob talks a little bit about how, from his experience in organizations, a lot of the problems that we will be talking about during this episode today that Peter saw in 1969 or in the 60s, Bob still sees well into the 21st century.
As Rohin said, I also did not know about the Peter Principle as such. But yeah, I've experienced it. So that was sort of the fun bit, I think, especially at the beginning with all the examples. You do feel like, yes, I've seen that before. I've been there. Yes, totally agree. And you kind of get that kind of internal rage where you go to a place and it's like, oh, I'm sure somebody could do their job. Like, why aren't people doing their job? So I found it completely fascinating from that point of view. And it was, I would say it's definitely among many of the readings that we've done, definitely one of the most timeless ones, as in, if I were to read it, I would not have an idea of if it's yesterday, 10 years ago, or 100. I felt that this is also for the language. It's one of those that really resonates a lot over time in its principles, basically.
Okay, so I feel that I have to disclose that I knew the principle, in part maybe because I, you know, impressed on expertise, and one of the questions is exactly about the matching of experts into jobs, right? So people have mentioned that to me, that, oh, you should look into that. And I'm glad I finally read cover to cover now. I felt that it was interesting to see the moves that Miranda, I think, is referring to. So there are rich examples, right? At some point, I was not sure if were from real research and real cases or just invented. But the moves that they illustrate on exactly how people try to manage the perception people have about the expertise, which is something that made me think about our episode on Goffman, for example, or the ways in which people are slotted into particular jobs and roles in which they're not competent for, right? That is not just necessarily vertical, but also there's some movement. All of that was a nice taxonomy of all of these things that we have same, but didn't have a label for. So I really enjoyed that. But it's funny because, like Miranda, there were many things that made me feel this was from a particular time in which we would imagine our careers and jobs as a progression within one organization in a traditional hierarchy and so on. And some references about, you know, employment security that is implicit into the text made me think that it's, you know, it is a particular system. I think that the diagnosis is timeless and the anecdotes as well, right? But I think it would be interesting at some point to also think about what does it mean to think of hierarchy and careers in our current time, but maybe probably for the second part of our conversation.
Yeah, thanks all. And let me start by just sort of painting a picture for the listeners of how this was written. As we talked about the anecdotes, let me just sort of highlight a particular anecdote, which is one of the ones early in the book, to get a sense of, yeah, you could probably see the realism, but you wonder, is this really the true story, or is it a composite of things, or is it exaggerated? So I have open on page in the edition I have here, page 23, and this is how he introduced all the vignettes. Service Industries File, Case Number 3. E. Tinker. That's the name of the person in question. So the name is always chosen. You know, obviously, this is an attempt to hide the, you know, protect the innocent kind of thing. But the names are always chosen somewhat humorously to reflect something about the industry in question. E. Tinker was exceptionally zealous and intelligent as an apprentice at some auto repair and soon rose to journeyman mechanic. In this job, he showed outstanding ability in diagnosing obscure faults and endless patience in correcting them. Da-da-da-da-da. He was promoted to foreman of the repair shop. But here his love of things mechanical and his perfectionism became liabilities. End result, skipping all the way to the bottom, he was a competent mechanic, but now an incompetent foreman. So that's the types of the style in which the vignettes come in. The reason why they're plausible is because they're presented very simply. This is only about, you know, a couple of paragraphs long. Every vignette is that short and sweet. They strip away a lot of the details that might explain what we mean by incompetent, but there's enough given. Like the very strengths in which somebody brought into the performance of the current position became liabilities. That's a common theme in a lot of these. It became liabilities in the next position, which then rendered them not only incompetent of doing that next higher job, but essentially frozen there. No, there's no going back. There's no other options. They're just basically stagnant for the rest of their working lives. And so you multiply that by several dozen of these types of vignettes throughout the book, and you get a sense of what the tone is.
Yeah, and so I found it interesting how it's simple examples, but also kind of gets the point across. It's something that also Bob Sutton referred to in the beginning, where it sounds like these were all actual case studies that were then kind of both anonymized and somewhat trivialized. But that's also part of the parody, right? So it's not just the cases, but the authors will then make exorbitant. So for example, when they talk about potential exceptions, they end the chapter saying, hence, there is no exception whatsoever to the Peter Principle, like in any hierarchy. So it's part of also just the stylistic choice, I would say, of this. To Pedro's point, I mean, Pedro, I was thinking of you a lot while reading this book, because it basically says, you know, bureaucracies promote everyone to sit at their level of incompetence. It's true that to some extent, it's different today, but there's two key points here. One is that the Peter Principle starts with the phrase in a hierarchy. And so that's a key conditional. So if you are in a more flat kind of a decentralized structure or a startup or a platform where it isn't hierarchical, and I would kind of assume that these authors would use hierarchy and bureaucracy kind of interchangeably. But if it's not, then the principle doesn't necessarily even apply. It starts with kind of in a hierarchy. This is what you see. But then I did think a bit about if the culture has changed in terms of there was an element of loyalty being valued and seniority being valued in the past where you are a company man or woman. And is that still the case? But if I think about places like, let's say, consulting, law firms, academia, where you have at the highest level this job security, whether it's tenure or partnership, I could still see it play out, because this is also kind of an end state analysis. So they might, let's say McKinsey has an up or out culture. It's true that if you're not competent, you will be kind of kicked out, but that's because there's still a point where it rests, which is once you've made it to partner, that's your level. And then they might, for example, give you a task of managing multiple countries, and that might be something that's your level of incompetence and you've stopped at. So I could still see it working, although I do think the culture has changed in terms of to what extent you would have any kind of steady state just because that person is loyal or a company person.
So you mentioned the vignettes, which are very vivid, right? There are also images. And when I was reading and trying to understand exactly, okay, it's satire, but it's trying to reveal something, I almost read it as fair tale book, like midnight stories about corporate life from the 60s. Even though it's timeless, as we said, because I think that it's trying to reveal something in the morale of the stories about what are the values that are important to us, what is the implicit thing through which life in organizations or in a particular type of organizations is oriented towards, right? So I felt that it was this satire was not necessarily plain haha comedy, right? But more about a way to render something that is very felt and use a different genre of communication to be able to get at some truths that we all assume and see, but find would be a bit hard to say explicitly out loud, right? Because it's kind of, you know, saying that the king is naked type of situation.
I really like that point, Pedro. And I think what sort of impresses me about several of the vignettes, especially at the beginning, is that you get a sense that the people who are incompetent and have progressed to a certain extent, that some of them, at least, it's very clear they're unhappy, as in they're not doing the job that they trained for, that they're good at, or that they've been doing. And I think that sort of starts to give a bit of a story or a bit of a debate around what does it mean to be successful, right? Is it progressing? Is it really sort of going to the top? Is it increasing your salary, or what is it truly? And I think that's an important debate, generally speaking, for us to keep in mind as any employee of any organization.
I think what's interesting is as he goes on and expounds on this notion of a hierarchology, that he not only shows that in a hierarchy, people get promoted to their position of incompetence, but there is also a flow, that upper out that was that you both mentioned there. This sense that there's a necessity to progress is driving people, and that drive or that flow is unavoidable. That says a lot about bureaucratic behavior, trying to highlight how self-destructive it, you know, if you look at it that way, is how self-destructive it could be. Because he even gives some examples later on when he starts talking about people who try to buck the principle, to say that, okay, I am satisfied. I have reached the level, I forget which chapter this was, I've reached the level that I want to get to. I don't really want to go higher anymore. And then what happens is that something else gets in the way that pushes them to go forward, to be promoted. In one case, which I thought was a really funny case, is one where it's his wife who then thinks so much less of the worker that he does not desire promotion. And she wants nice things, or, you know, wants to reap the benefits of the higher salary. And how dare you not go chase a promotion? I would rather you be more successful and incompetent than happy and poor, you know, something to that effect. Now, again, I don't know if that's a combination of vignettes. This particular vignette ends with a divorce, but it's interesting that the principle is not just a principle alone. It drives so many other behaviors that he tries to explain, again, through satirical example.
I mean, on the same thread around what Miranda has brought up about how motivation matters, I do think, and this reminds me, Pedro, of what you were saying, where times have changed, but maybe we can separate out to what extent have the mechanics of hierarchy and hence hierarchology changed? Or is it just that the people in the hierarchy and their motivations? So, for example, maybe in the past, the motivation to rise was purely that an empty motivation in some sense. You just want the title and the salary. Now, maybe if I go back to that example of someone who's made it to partner, but now they're given a responsibility for multiple countries, maybe their motivation is a learning motivation. They actually do want to know what it's like to be overseeing different territories or something like that. And if it's a learning motivation, then it's quite possible that they change their skill sets as well. And so they're perhaps an implicit assumption here that your competence is mapped out already, and then you rise up and at some point you've reached the limit. You've, like, your tank is empty or something like that. Versus in today's world, there's a lot more of your competence itself is ever changing and evolving, which complicates this to some extent.
Yeah, certainly learning was conspicuous absence, right, in the book. But I want to go back to what Miranda was talking about in terms of what I interpret as how hierarchy is a value, right? So it's not just the function of organizing different tasks across different people and how, you know, we structure work and responsibilities, but also how it is identified as a way for people, for their life, for their career, and a career being not just the work that you do, but the employment situation that you have, what you can afford, what kind of life do you have, and how they kind of, you know, come together into this, right? And how, given the way organizations are structured, and to some extent still today, it's hard to untangle, because to go back to what Tom was saying, right? That's why it's hard to think, and he talks about it towards the end of the book, that there is a social pressure that people will be and will expect or will lament that they're trying to get ahead by getting up. And what is fun is that the kind of the method of the book is sort of providing tactics through which one can continue to do one's job quietly and successfully while parading to some extent the fact that they're not fully competent, so therefore they do not need to be moved, right? So there's this kind of, you know, general message. It's more about maybe poking irony or trying to spell out the assumption, trying to say maybe we would be more satisfied if we didn't desire that so much. That's something that I got as a general message.
What I'd like to offer, too, getting on that point of learning, is that I find it interesting that while incompetence is used liberally throughout the book, it's never actually defined, and it seems to encompass almost such a broad array of ills that you can almost brand anything that angers you or sets you off as being the result of someone else's incompetence. I think in some way that's somewhat intentional, because it sort of draws it draws attention to more or less the emotions associated with encountering incompetence. But I think about some of the examples that he provides, and by unpacking incompetence a little bit, we can kind of see different phenomena taking place about why somebody fails. You know, the one that I read, that was a case where the particular skills were not useful at all, that the talents that the person had were not useful at all at the next level. It required different talents that the individual was not set to acquire, perhaps didn't, you know, whether or not he desired to acquire it doesn't matter. In other cases, it seemed like it was one where the situation was the problem. That is, that an individual did well, got up to this particular point, may not even had a chance to demonstrate good performance, but a situation happened whereby then the individual was put in a bad light, in essence kind of branded as incompetent, even though, for all we know, because these are simplified examples, the individual may have acted competently, but it did not appear so because the result was awful. And then you have others where it just seems like, you know, it wasn't so much that the skills that already had were a liability, but just simply that the level within the hierarchy required a much broader view or what have you, and the individual ended up just being a micromanager because they were only able to think in terms of the situations that they had been in before. Those are just three that cross my mind, and I'm sure there's plenty more. So if you have such an umbrella term for so many different phenomena, it makes it kind of easy to brand everything as incompetence, doesn't it?
So a quick thing on that, because as I was reading, I was trying to make, you know, mental list of what are the characteristics or sources of the incompetence they are talking about. And some of them seem to be purely organizational. So let's say, paraphrasing Garfinkel, good organizational reasons for bad organizational behavior, in which was a sort of a clash between ideals and rules, right? Another was this potential means ends displacement, right? That what would be done given what is understood to be the immediate objective is not aligned with what would be like a more social, broader mission of the organization in dealing with people that require some services, right? So there was some about this myopia that we're talking about, Tom, right? So there was like some of them I could see they were result of a system issue, but many and recurring, and I think that's what the principle is known for mostly, is that in rising up, people takes a new job, which usually has a management component, and he gives many examples that you're no longer, your technical skill is relevant because you're not doing the same job, you're doing a different type of job, you're supervising people, and you had, you know, you were selected on the basis of your technical skill, and assuming that, as we are assuming, there is no training was provided, and basically the person just, you know, found having all sorts of skill deficiencies because the, even though it was up in the hierarchy, the nature of the job has shifted, right? Because it's not just about being a technical expert in a particular domain. So I think that was very interesting. I think that is what usually I at least associated the principle with, these trade-offs of who to select for a managerial position and how that can be more or less assessed based on prior technical performance and who gets, you know, who should be a good manager. People that are generalists, people that are specialists with some skills, right? That's, I think that's one of the points that the principal, you know, touches on.
Yeah, I just want to add to that that I think you've touched on something important there, which is core across all the chapters of the book, which is that idea that things change. The way kind of in OB classrooms today, in organizational behavior classrooms today, we might say it to MBAs is what got you here won't get you there. And so then what happens is if you've just gotten, let's say, to a managerial role by virtue of being very good at a technical skill, that won't now get you to your next promotion because you need to, again, like we said, learn and reskill. And then I think the Peter Principle book talks about how some of this might be inherently a trade-off, where it reminds me of there was an article in the Financial Times, I think literally as of this recording today, where they talked about how a lot of CFOs are starting to become CEOs in recent times compared to the past, where that was not a pathway as much to the CEO role. And then on the one hand, what you have is CFOs tend to be much more detail-oriented and better at kind of being a bit balanced towards risk and either risk averse or just a balanced risk management. But then what you see is the reasons that they are picked for also hurt them in their new job, because then you find that at least in the early years, these CFO turned CEOs perform less well because there's less of kind of new ideas and new sales pipeline or new visionary stuff happening. And so sometimes your competences themselves can be at odds with what you're being promoted into. And then part of the interesting implication then is from the promoter's point of view. So then, you know, what is it, to what extent should we be promoting based on how good they are at their job versus somehow trying to glean these latent or implicit competence for what we actually need them for the post that's needed. A lot of promotion, and this comes also to the means ends point, which I wanted to raise. And Pedro, you brought it up as well, where we talked about, and Miranda talked about how hierarchy is almost like a value in this book, where it's you just want to move up the hierarchy for its own sake. But at one point in the book, they also suggest that hierarchy shapes your values in the sense that you start to value means over ends. And so then what happens is if you are the person doing the job, you're following protocol. And so some of the incompetence definition, like Tom said, is more about the customer being annoyed because the customer is not getting the ends that they want while the supplier is focused on the means. But then from the promoter's point of view, they're happy with that because the promoter also values the means over their ends. And so they like the fact that the worker is following due process. And I want to just read out a fun quote from the book where I think it's in chapter three, where he's giving an example of this idea of this inversion where people start prioritizing the means over the ends, but still get promoted for that. And the author says, he uses an example of someone in a liquor store, I think it's in Canada or near the border, where he's trying to buy alcohol and then he'll take it back across the US. And he's asking the liquor store person what the customs laws are, how much can I buy? And the liquor store person says, I can't tell you that. I'm not, you know, allowed to give official customs rules and regulations. You have to ask the customs person. And the customer says, but I'm here now and I want to know now so that I can buy the bottles now. And then the authors say, while describing this kind of liquor store worker, they say he no longer sees himself as existing to serve the public. In fact, he sees the public as the raw material that serves to maintain him, the forms, the rules, and the whole hierarchy.
He went to talk about other things than just incompetence. He also talked about perils of the supercompetent, of those who are above and beyond. He gives some cases of that, of somebody who, like, excelled in the case of being excellent, pissed people off, and comes to the paradox of these cases illustrate the fact that in most hierarchies, supercompetence is more objectionable than incompetence. And what this raised in my mind was we've covered a couple of episodes on the industrial side of things where you had the rate busters who were known for overworking and therefore driving up expectations of other workers who then would resent it. So this is kind of like the same phenomenon put another way. It's just sort of funny that we can see not just within business settings or hierarchies, we can see this relate to other industrial settings and whatnot.
And that's also where I just want to draw out an example from the Bob Sutton forward, because that's 2009, and again shows how it's a lasting phenomenon as well. He talks about in his case, which is the education sector, universities and academia, he says, several fantastic teachers that I know at prestigious universities have been pressured by peers and leaders to do a worse job of teaching because, quote unquote, you are making everyone else look bad. One of these professors insists that he received tenure partly because he worked to earn teaching evaluations that were no better than those of the professors who evaluated his tenure case. So yeah, it is quite widespread and still present today.
It is, it's a bit sad, this part of the principle which feeds into this idea of, you know, don't outshine us, don't outshine, because it doesn't make us look good. So it's interesting sort of looking at those hiring and promotion decisions. What are they actually fueled by? Definitely one of the interesting parts of the book. But I wanted to just talk a little bit about maybe the beginning of the book and the examples that are kind of put forward, especially as somebody who really, in all honesty, I didn't know about this at all. Like, I know it's sort of, you know, I got the concept, but I did not know what I was walking into. The examples picked are very much around disappointments or things not working, sometimes even very simple ones. And it seems like the responsibility around this product or whatever that is not working or this process is always around management or incompetence. And I think if we were to sort of take a step back, not knowing what comes after in the book, it does fail to recognize that perhaps there could have been other factors in play. It's not only because of incompetent management, but absolutely the book has got a very strong satirical and a very clear aim from the start. So I did find that fascinating, how every diverse example was connected back to management incompetence. That was my take on the beginning of the book.
At some point, I started thinking that even though there is all of these potential causes, there is all of this debate running across of lack of skills in a managerial position, but especially towards the end, because the take-home lesson is that maybe you should question this idea about, you know, going ahead for its own sake, the notion that incompetence is proposed seems very close to a problem of not being able to thrive, not being able to find, I don't want to say fulfillment, I can't find the right word, but be able to really excel as one does one job, right? That one finds almost trapped into at some point, rising to a point that you can no longer feel that you are fully expressing, almost like a form of alienation, that you have been placed in a particular position because it's the way structure works and that's the culture that pushes for trying to get ahead no matter what. And then the actual work that you do is not fulfilling, right? But that's what you have to do, right? So that is kind of, you know, this incompetence is coded in terms that the person is not fully using one's skills and feeling, you know, a sense of, let's say, belonging or worthiness, meaningfulness. We would probably use the current language.
To me, it feeds very much into this idea of what do I want from my professional life? What am I pursuing? But also, to a certain extent, I do like how Pedro has mentioned the word trapped, because this was one of my sort of side thoughts when I was reading it. Why stay in this organization, right? And obviously, perhaps today's world is a little bit different, where the idea of not being, loyal to one organization is, you know, it's not an idea that holds anymore. It's, especially in certain countries and in certain markets, it's fine to have multiple experiences and to shift and to move and so on. But it does feel like a trap. And the question is, where is the agency of the employee? Why is that not part of the picture in the narrative that is presented?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think some of it is because perhaps at the time that this was written, we weren't thinking in those terms. We weren't thinking about self-actualization to that same extent, not the way that we do now. What I think, and we'll probably get this more into part two, self-actualization has its own sense of entrapment. Like the alternative is not necessarily better than what's presented in this book. But the trap that I sense, I mean, if there is one thing that kind of makes a lot of these vignettes really sing and dance, is it isn't just a promotion. It is a promotion to a markedly different status. Like you were saying, like to a management or to a supervisory position, there's a whole identity transition that fails to happen, fails to follow that, where we haven't really understood the role that we're going into, as opposed to, say, if you were moving from one entry level to just a higher entry level type of a work or something like that. Just say you were on a coal mining team from the Tristan Bamforth case, and you just move from, say, being number 8 in the team to number 7, that change in status doesn't really accompany it. So even if you do sense a little bit different, it may not be as felt so starkly as all of a sudden you're elevated to the foreman position, where you really are need to be a different person, and you need to adapt, and you may not be equipped to do so.
So two things. One, on the sense of entrapment, I think it's interesting that later in the book, they talk about the medical and psychological manifestations of, you know, the stress of having reached the full principle, right? Being at a level of incompetence that you can no longer expect any progression back or towards a sense of a role, a task that you find some fulfillment or is aligned with what is said to be your skills or desires. So there is, I think that was very compelling, right? And that was also something that was very timeless, right? The sense in which work and the kind of job that you do and the kind of, you know, career that you have and how these things go together can have physical forms. And again, you mentioned Tristan Bamforth, right? It's very interesting that one, what motivated that research was the fact that a change in the work system that was like expected to improve the conditions of the work through mechanization was actually generating so much low morale and absenteeism and so on, physical manifestations. The other thing I wanted to go back, because I'm trying to connect our insights to some of the debates in some different chapters, is I did see a sense of agency, but the agency, because it was under this cultural umbrella that did not question the value of hierarchy, was within how to get ahead, how to manipulate the perception. So there is, you know, I think it's in chapter, in my version 4 and 5, in which they talk about the actual strategies to achieve promotion. He talks about the push and the pull, and there's a lot about the importance of what I would call basically patronage systems, right? Which, by the way, it's one of the things that bureaucracies try to go against. So the idea that you're not just going ahead or being hired on the basis of ties and preferences and matching of status, which always happens in bureaucracies, but the idea of a bureaucratic organization was to try to stop that. And there is also the tactics, which maybe, you know, I'll say that are more positive towards the end of the book, that is exactly how people try to carve out and manipulate the perception so they can stay in the role. So there's all these micro strategies in how people manipulate imagery and create ties and try to cope with particular situations. I think that was one of the strong richness of the book.
Yeah, and I do think the entrapment thing is still perhaps a powerful mechanism, and maybe this is kind of me giving more agency to the structure than to the individual. But because the idea is, if let's say if you're a software engineer joined a kind of fast moving startup, and you like what you do, but let's say you like it, but you're not yet, you're working, let's say, agentically towards something more fulfilling. So you want to, let's say, be working on a full product, not just a piece of it or not just a part of it. You want to see things end to end. You might get the first promotion, the next promotion, until you are in that place where you're fulfilled and happy and doing well. But that's when a further promotion will be offered to you because you're fulfilled and happy and doing well. And then the way any hierarchy works is the higher up you go, the more your job becomes HR because you're managing people under you. Even in, you know, a university department, a kind of a junior prof has to do less mandatory trainings than the department chair because they have to worry about whatever reporting, etc., for people below them. And then it's a question of assuming you buy into that value of moving up. But even if it's not moving up, but you buy into other life values, let's say the promotion means you can pay off your mortgage much faster than if you stay in your current role, you're quite likely to take that promotion until you're now at that level of incompetence where you're not even being offered more money or more status. So I think there is a thing that drives people one step above fulfillment, which is that level of incompetence. And that they choose, like the book kind of acknowledges, because of these kinds of capitalistic values of kind of more is better. But it doesn't have to be just a bureaucratic value of I want to be VP. It can simply be, like I said, the promotion comes with a raise and I'll pay my mortgage off faster.
Like another term that alluded to was the final placement syndrome. Like I said, he had a glossary of about 200 terms at the back of all of the ones that he defined in the book. And he was coming up with a label for everything. But a few terms appear consistently. And final placement syndrome was one of them. And this is that state in which you have achieved your level of incompetence. And therefore, you are essentially done. and achieving final placement syndrome becomes, or the all of the implications of achieving, of trying to break out or trying to disrupt final placement syndrome dominates a big chunk of the book. I do want to correct myself in one point, because there was a passage in one page, in one of the later pages, where he did actually describe different types of incompetence. So he still never defined it. But what he did say was that there were like four classes of incompetence. You could be incompetent or promoted beyond your physical competence. You could be promoted beyond your social competence, which means that you are unable to enter into the social circles that the higher status affords you. Beyond emotional competence, which means that your ability to be resilient and handle the stresses of the higher job is beyond your capacity. And mental competence, which is just basically you are don't have the skills or talent to be able to go on. So I do want to correct myself there. So achieving final placement syndrome can happen in many ways. And so it's just naturally seems to be like a easy trap to fall into. Like at some point, you're going to run up against these different shortcomings that are going to prevent you from being able to do much else.
So besides the multiple dimensions of incompetence, I thought it was also very compelling in this effort of creating taxonomies, right? Of strategies and ways in which this process takes place or the implications of the principle. One was at the beginning in which they talk about apparent exceptions, in which they talk about exactly trying to complexify the idea that it's not just about rising up vertically, but there is these things that appear to be placement, let's call it, or matching of people into tasks that seems to be an exception. But in reality, there are ways to continue the same principle. And he talks about, for example, how sometimes people are parked in particular places through a pseudo promotion, right? So this way, they find a way into something that is not really, you know, adding much value, and neither for them nor for the organization, but this way is like they're just put there. Or how there are, you know, another form of pseudo promotion, which just a longer title is created, right? That someone just is put somewhere, there's no, a new space is created, a new box in the chart is created without no one under, right? So it's kind of a way to, it's a lot, let's say it's horizontally or in different moves. So I think that was also interesting that, you know, tries to see that the way in which someone finds oneself in a role for which one lacks competence can also happen in these more indirect ways. And the other one I think that is worth bringing up are the strategies that people once in such incompetent role, which he assumes to be eventually, potentially anyone in a hierarchical organization, try to, let's say, create a facade of competence, right? So how one lives in an incompetent position. And again, the different, I think he calls it forms that are substitutions, right? So how people may focus on a particular aspect of the job, a particular subtask, or is always focusing on the preparation for something, not the actual thing, and spend a lot of time talking about the work, not doing the work. So there's all of these rhetorical, dramaturgical performances in which people are able to live this life quite peacefully, potentially, in such incompetent position.
I think that's a really good point, and it builds into a question I had at the back of my mind. do these people know that they are incompetent? Because I think that's a crucial question, right? I don't know. For how I sort of try and keep to professional standards, I do not like when I feel incompetent at something. And I do everything I can to improve, to learn, to develop, or maybe to say, look, actually, I'm not the right person for this thing. Because I don't like the feeling of incompetence. But that builds into, are you aware of it? Because if you're aware of it, then you can feel it. But if you're not aware of it, you may just easily sail along with, you know, doing your stuff. And I think that's a good point to raise, because who is going to tell you that you are the incompetent, right? Is it going to be somebody else? Is somebody actually going to tell you, look, the nature of your role has actually radically changed? Or are you just going to discover it, you know, randomly? And I think this builds into also another point that I wanted to make, which was the nature of management per se. What I pick up between the lines is that there is some of these episodes or examples of incompetence are examples of somebody managing perhaps teams or people in a sense of telling them what to do or having to meet certain standard procedures, whether it be quality assurance or doing a lot of representation things. But then there's another part which I find particularly interesting because it's dear to my heart and just an area that I know very well, which is the expectation that these people are going to teach the newer, lower ranking employees the craft or the role. And I think whatever happens, whatever it is along this spectrum, and in some cases it's a bit of both, what is missing is the awareness that teaching something or managing people or observing all those standard bureaucratic procedures requires skills of a certain kind. And I think we mentioned it earlier, you need to learn them. But if you're not aware that that's actually the new game that you're playing, then we do have another big problem in the picture.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.